Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Nearly every major city in America has one, but they don't always use the word ghetto. It's a part of the city where it's populated mainly by African Americans and has problems with poverty, crime, health issues like a high infant mortality. But what to do about it has been a long, vexing question for America. In 1965, Kenneth Clark wrote the book, Dark Ghetto, Dilemmas of Social Power. And he wrote in the intro, "This study of the Negro ghetto is an attempt to understand the combined problems of the confined Negro and the problems of the slum. Some of the problems of the lower class Negro are similar to and identical with the problems of poor people and slums in general. But in America, the white poor and slum dweller have the advantage of the social and psychological reality, which is an essential aspect of American racism. That is, the belief that they can rise economically and escape from the slums. The Negro believes himself to be closely confined to the pervasive low status of the ghetto." In a new book that takes a look at the same problem, Dark Ghettos, Injustice, Dissent, and Reform, the author is Tommy Shelby. He's a professor of African and African-American studies and philosophy at Harvard University. And Tommy, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So this quote that we have from Kenneth Clark, 1965, is it still true today?
Well, certainly certain parts of it. I think when Kenneth Clark was writing, a much larger percentage of black Americans were confined to what he called ghetto neighborhoods, though that's not true now. There are certainly many black Americans who have managed to do quite well for themselves. Some of them have risen to the professional managerial class. Some are working class but don't live in poverty. But there's still a pretty large segment of the black population that is confined to these stigmatized neighborhoods where segregation is a fact of life, where one faces many difficulties that, as he would say, that are shared with other poor people, but some that are unique to the condition of those in such communities.
So I want to play a clip here, and this is with Kenneth Clark interviewing James Baldwin, talking about where Mr. Baldwin grew up. And so here, let's listen.
I was born in Harlem, Harlem Hospital, you know, and we grew up. First house I remember was on Park Avenue, which is not the American Park Avenue, or maybe it is the American Park Avenue.
Uptown Park Avenue.
Uptown Park Avenue, where the railroad tracks are. And we used to play on the roof and in the, I can't call it an alley, but near the river. It was a kind of dump, garbage dump. And that was the first, those were the first scenes I remember. I remember my father had trouble keeping us alive. There were nine of us. And I was the oldest, so I took care of the kids and dealt with Daddy. I understand much better now. Part of his problem was he couldn't feed his kids. But I was a kid and I didn't know that. And he was very religious, very rigid. He kept us together, I must say. And when I look back on it, after it was nearly 40 years ago that I was born, I think back of am I growing up, and walks that same block today because it's still there. And think of the kids on that block now. I'm aware that something terrible has happened, which is very hard to describe. People talk about progress, and I look at Harlem, which I really know. I know it like I know my hand. And it is much worse there today than it was when I was growing up.
Would you say this is true of the schools, too?
It's much worse in the schools.
That was recorded in 1963, James Baldwin and Kenneth Clark. The reason I wanted to play that clip, really, because I wanted to really think about the humanity and the people, and we're talking about people. This is not about geography. This is about people. Tommy?
That's right. No, and it's important. The way he started, it's always important to remember, even people who are living under even quite oppressive circumstances, still are able to find a sense of community, to and find ways of enjoying themselves. They can be creative. They can make a lot out of nothing sometimes, and it's important to keep that in mind. And both James Baldwin and Kenneth Clark, I think, in their writings would often bring out that that's a feature of black life, even when it's under very constricted circumstances, even under rather serious injustice, people still are able to find beauty and community and fun and pleasure in their lives. But that I take it they could find maybe much more of that
in the Hamptons.
Beauty and pleasure under very different circumstances.
Sure, but so tell me what you call a ghetto.
Well, I think of ghettos not much different from the way that Kenneth Clark did. I mean, these would be neighborhoods with a high concentration of disadvantage, certainly poverty, but perhaps other forms of disadvantage. But also, importantly, these are places that are racially stigmatized and segregated, where the segregation here is involuntary. That is, people might like to have very different communities or move out of their community, but because of discrimination, because of lack of economic resources, because of lack of earning power, they're unable to leave those places. And the sites of their communities are sites from the outside are seen as the dangerous places that you don't go to, the places that the people who live there, you know, merit one's contempt. And, you know, that leads to a very humiliating form of existence. Makes it difficult to, you know, maintain a sense of pride in the place that you live in, and puts you in a very combative relationship to others who live outside it.
Do we really still use the word ghetto? I thought that word has been stigmatized to a point where we can't actually use it in conversations because people react to it so harshly.
Well, I guess it's probably fair to say that it depends on who's using it. Probably it's like some other words, like maybe the N-word, where there some people, when they use it, it's okay, and others, when they use it, maybe it's more problematic. Many social scientists today, including many of my colleagues like William Julius Wilson, continue to use it, again, in much the same way that Kenneth Clark did, as a useful analytical concept for understanding a particular form of disadvantage. Lots of people in the 60s and 70s used the term without worrying about the stigma. So across the mainstream civil rights, it was true of the Black Power community. So you'll see Martin Luther King and Malcolm X using the word ghetto. But I think part of the reason why it's not used as much now, or people see it as stigmatizing, is partly because of the thing I mentioned earlier. That is, now you have a much larger group of blacks, not just a few token blacks, a much larger group of blacks who, through educational opportunities, are able to advance themselves, you know, economically, and their visibility, their prominence, is often used as a way to criticize those left behind, right? So you can point to that larger black middle class and say, and look how well they're doing. Things can't be so bad.
You sure, know, but these are people, they have to be so, you know, perfect. You don't get a second bounce. You don't get a second chance. And you wonder if that is, you know, something you can really draw comparisons off of. We got to take a break here. We're going to continue our conversation with Tommy Shelby. The book is Dark Ghettos, Injustice, Dissent, and Reform. I want to get into all that injustice, dissent, and reform. When we come back from the break, call in. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. You take a segment of the population, you force them to live in a part of the city that has bad sanitation, overcrowding, bad schools, lousy food choices, no job opportunities, it's thick with crime, and even worse stuff's going on. What happens to those people? This is called a ghetto. And why do they persist? And is there a ghetto solution? We're speaking with Tommy Shelby. He's the author of the book Dark Ghettos, Injustice, Dissent, and Reform. So, Tommy, when it seemed like the structure of having ghettos, the creation of a ghetto, is part of a structural racism, that you put people in this one place and you force them to live under terrible conditions, and then you look at them and say, why don't they improve their own lives?
Well, that's certainly part of it. I usually use the word institutional racism to refer to, I think, what you have in mind, which has more to do with the ways in which institutions are structured and officials within them can be biased in ways that can lead to people being mistreated, discriminated against, otherwise excluded or disadvantaged, and to use structural racism to refer to the ways in which past racism impacts our present. But that's, I think, the story of racism, whether ongoing racism or past racism, is only part of the story. I think the other part of the story has to do with questions of economic injustice, that have more to do with the way in which the society is structured unfairly with respect to both how income and wealth are distributed, but also how work is distributed and who has to do what work and who is able to escape burdensome, menial, sometimes stigmatizing work. So I think it's important to always emphasize both the racial injustice dimensions and the economic injustice dimensions when thinking about the ghetto. I'm reluctant to see the problem as solely a matter of past and present racism.
So the ghetto identity, what is that?
Well, I think I don't use that in a way to affirm it. I think that some social scientists believe, and some people in the broader public probably believe, that there's a kind of culture that's prominent in some of these communities where people identify with, if you like, transgression, deviance from mainstream norms. And so talk of a ghetto identity can sometimes be used to describe that transgressive sorts of behavior. And sometimes it's used, as mentioning earlier, as a kind of epithet that can be used to denigrate people in these communities, and sometimes used even amongst more advantaged blacks to criticize poorer blacks.
Like we hear, that's so ghetto.
Exactly, right, which is partly sometimes an intra-group, that is amongst blacks, an intra-group kind of epithet used to describe behavior that is seen as troubling and characteristic of the poor. Sometimes, though, it can be used in a positive way, because people can often identify, as we talked about earlier, with the forms of community and interaction that develop in these communities, and might use that so ghetto in a positive way as a something to take pride in, as a way of distinguishing oneself from those who are not a part of those communities. So it's a complex way of using the term, I think.
But looking back at the Kenneth Clark quote that we had about how there's a problem with a psychological reality of people who are living in the ghetto, where they don't see any way to rise economically and escape from the slums, as he says. And so they will adopt this idea of, I am living in an unjust society, and so therefore, why should I follow their rules?
That's right. I think that a lot of people, I wouldn't want to say everyone, and maybe not even a majority, I'm not sure, but there are certainly some people who live in these communities who have an understanding of why, understanding of their plight and the source of it. They often have a sense that they are facing circumstances not of their choosing that really limit their opportunities and their liberty. And once that sense that these constrictive circumstances, these unjust constraints, are pervasive and systematic, one can begin to think that the appropriate posture to take toward it is one of defiance, of one of resistance, one where you refuse to go along with what you take to be unreasonable expectations about how you ought to live and what you ought to do. And so I think that Clark is picking up on something very real in the lives of people in these communities, a kind of morality of resistance or ethic of resistance. And sometimes it's not fully articulated. Sometimes it is. And I think that's what he's pointing to, and is a lot of what I want to emphasize in my book.
And so we talk about black self-segregation, that as we hear this from people, is that they want to live in the ghetto because this is they want to be among the people that they have a shared history and culture.
Well, it's certainly true. There are some people who live in these communities who enjoy being around people who have a similar life experience and similar tastes and cultural attachments. I wouldn't want to say they want to live in a ghetto. I mean, they don't want to live under concentrated disadvantage and constricted circumstances, but they might like to live in black communities. So often if you're forced to choose between, you know, if all you have is the ghetto as is, you don't have a thriving black community, you have to choose whether, if you have a choice, whether to leave those communities if the opportunities arise, or whether to stay and deal with the difficulties that you face within them. But I wouldn't want to describe it as people are selecting to live under these circumstances. They're not selecting to live where they're going to be discriminated against and where they have few opportunities and inadequate public services.
And they should have the option to live wherever they want.
That's what I think. So I'm neither, if you like, an integrationist nor a separatist. I believe in individual liberty, and people should be able to choose the communities that they want to be a part of, provided they're not acting on, you know, immoral sentiments or beliefs. It's not based on any kind of hostility toward other groups, but it's based on an affinity for members of their own communities. And that can be a perfectly legitimate choice and a perfectly justifiable exercise of our freedoms.
Our number is 210-614-8980 if you want to join our conversation as we talk with Tommy Shelby about his book, Dark Ghettos, The Injustice, Dissent, and Reform. Renee is on the line. Hey, Renee, welcome to The Source, and you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to share that at one time, one of our former county commissioners came to talk to a large group of community members protesting a rezoning for an apartment complex that's already built. And basically my comment to him was he was just going to create a ghetto scenario for us because we have four existing very low-income subsidized housing areas, and there's nothing wrong with that, but they don't provide the services for the individuals. You know, I'm talking about after-school programming, health wellness programming. They don't help the kids out. They don't go and make sure that the schools get extra help with this infusion of children. You know, there's a lot of social baggage that comes with individuals that are going and struggling. And then there's a lack of economic opportunity. And that's, to me, that was kind of like the beginning of a ghetto scenario. And if you build and add more onto that, I think you create a really terrible situation and an unjust one for individuals trying to make it in life. And I think we got it here in San Antonio. And if we look at Bexar County in the east side where you had that abandoned community with the trash issue, I mean, couldn't that also be, you know, an example? And I think that maybe, you know, geographically it may be a little different, but it's still very much the same. You got oppressed people and very terrible conditions.
Renee, thank you for your call. I appreciate your input here. And so, Tommy, as what Renee is talking about, we concentrations of poverty and then abandonment of services. It seemed like if you got all the poor people in one place, it would be easier to provide services, and maybe you could actually do it if it was a priority.
Well, you might be able to. I mean, it's difficult because you do need more than just social services. You want other things to be there as well. You know, you need quality schools. You need businesses that cater to the needs there. You need access to public transportation, other sorts of things as well. So I agree with your caller, Renee, that's you don't want to just move poor people around without providing them with opportunities and services and, you know, avenues to improve their lives. And of course, if it's very easy to just focus on, you know, how do we help them? How do we help them? But part of what I want to emphasize is that the presence of ghettos in our cities across the country are, I think, a sign of something deeper about the way we structure our lives together, that go to questions of inequality that we've seen people protesting about over the years and that we've still yet to kind of really reckon with. So if you just leave things as they are and with great economic inequality, great wealth inequality, and just move poor people around, you can't really expect to make much progress on the problem, I don't think.
But what about the role of criminal justice reform in dealing with ghettos?
I think it's crucially important. There are many things that need to be done there, and we're not getting quite the discussion that I would like either. I mean, but I would emphasize that it's very easy. What we've done, I think, over the years is use the criminal justice system as a way to deal with social problems that really should be dealt with elsewhere, dealt with by trying to create a fair social structure, trying to improve our schools, trying to distribute income and wealth in a way that's equitable. And so what we do is we leave people in those situations, and sometimes they will, acting out of need or frustration or anger or resentment, will break the law. And we respond to that, which you have to respond to in some way, especially if it's violent.
But sometimes it's over-policing, and then there's extra long sentencing. Dark Ghettos, The Dark Ghettos, Injustice, Dissent, and Reform. The author is Tommy Shelby. Tommy, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the air with us.
Thanks for having me.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.